cried, "Give me my money! Who's got my money? Who? Who?" And the wind blew, and the fire flared and flickered and snapped and popped, and the grave digger shivered and shook and cried, "Oh, Lordy, Lordy!" Suddenly, the front door flew open, and in walked the ghost of the dead woman, with her eyes wide open, staring at everything and seeing nothing, and the wind blew, and the money went clinkety-clink, and the fire flared and flickered and snapped and popped, and the ghost of the dead woman cried, "Oh, where is my money? Who's got my money? Ooh, ooh." And the grave digger moaned, "Oh, Lordy, Lordy." The ghost could hear her money going clinkety-clink, clinkety-clink in the tin box, but her dead eyes couldn't see the box, so she reached out with her arms and tried to find it. The wind went and the money rattled clinkety-clink, and the fire flared and flickered and snapped and popped, and the gravedigger shivered and shook and moaned, "Oh, Lordy, Lordy!" And the woman cried, "Give me my money! Who's got my money? Ooh, ooh! You've got it!"
The Bride. The minister's daughter had just gotten married. After the wedding ceremony, there was a great feast with music and dancing and contests and games, even old children's games. When they got to playing hide and seek, the bride decided to hide in her grandfather's trunk up in the attic. "They'll never find me there," she thought. As she was climbing into the trunk, the lid came down and cracked her on the head, and she fell unconscious inside. The lid slammed shut and locked. No one will ever know how long she called for help, or how hard she struggled to free herself from that tomb. Everyone in the village searched for her, and they looked almost everywhere, but no one thought of looking in the trunk. After a week, her brand new bridegroom and all the others gave her up for lost. Years later, a maid went up into the attic looking for something she needed. "Maybe it is in the trunk," she thought. She opened it and screamed. There lay the missing bride in her wedding dress. But by then, she was only a skeleton. Rings on her fingers. Daisy Clark had been in a coma for more than a month when the doctor said that she had finally died. She was buried on a cool summer day in a small cemetery about a mile from her house. "May she always rest in such peace," her husband said. But she didn't. Late that night, a grave robber with a shovel and a lantern began to dig her up. Since the ground was still soft, he quickly reached the coffin and got it open. His hunch was right. Daisy had been buried wearing two valuable rings, a wedding ring with a diamond in it, and a ring with a ruby that glowed as if it were alive. The thief got down on his knees and reached into the coffin to get the rings, but they were stuck fast on her fingers. So he decided that the only way to get them was to cut off her fingers with a knife. But when he cut into the finger with the wedding ring, it began to bleed, and Daisy Clark began to stir. Suddenly she sat up. Terrified, the thief scrambled to his feet. He accidentally kicked over the lantern and the light went out. He could hear Daisy climb out of her grave. As she moved past him in the dark, he stood there frozen with fear, clutching the knife in his hand. When Daisy saw him, she pulled her shroud around her and asked, "Who are you?" When the grave robber heard this corpse speak, he ran. Daisy shrugged her shoulders and walked on, and never once looked back. But in his fear and confusion, the thief fled in the wrong direction. He pitched headlong into her grave, fell on the knife, and stabbed himself. While Daisy walked home, the thief bled to death. The Drum. Once there were two sisters. Dolores was 7, and Sandra was 5. They lived in a small house in the country with their mother and their baby brother, Arthur. Their father was a seaman and was away on a long voyage. One day, Dolores and Sandra were running across a field near their house when they met a gypsy girl playing a drum. Her family was camping in the field for a few days. As the girl played, a little mechanical man and woman came out of the drum and danced. Dolores and Sandra had never seen such a drum, and they begged the girl to give it to them. She looked at them and laughed. "I will give it to you," she said, "but only if you are really bad. Come back tomorrow and tell me how bad you were, and I will see." As soon as the two sisters got home, they started shouting, which was against the rules of their house. Then they wrote all over the walls with their crayons. At supper, they spilled their food. And when it was time for bed, they wouldn't go. They did everything they could think of to upset their mother. They were really bad. Early the next morning, they hurried off to find the gypsy girl. "We were really bad yesterday," they told her, "so please give us the drum." But when they told her what they had done, the gypsy girl laughed. "Oh, you must be much worse than that if I'm to give you the drum," she said. As soon as Dolores and Sandra got home, they pulled up all the flowers in the garden. They let the pig out and chased it away. They tore their clothes. They sloshed in the mud. They were a lot worse than the day before. "If you do not stop," their mother said, "I will go away and take Arthur with me, and you will get a new mother with glass eyes and a wooden tail." Well, that scared Dolores and Sandra. They loved their mother, and they loved Arthur. They could not imagine being without them, and they began to cry. "I don't want to leave you," their mother said, "but unless you change your behavior, I will have to leave you." "We'll be good," the girls promised. Yet they did not really believe that their mother would go away. "She's just trying to scare us," Dolores said later. "We'll get the drum tomorrow," said Sandra. "Then we'll be good again." Early the next morning, they rushed off to find the gypsy girl. When they found her, she was playing the drum again, and the little man and woman were dancing. They told the gypsy girl how bad they had been the day before. "That must be bad enough to get the drum," they said. "Oh, no," said the gypsy girl. "You must be much worse than that." "But we promised our mother to be good from now on," said the girls. "If you really want the drum," said the gypsy girl, "you must be much worse." "It's only for one more day," Dolores told Sandra. "Then we will have the drum." "I hope you're right," Sandra said. As soon as they got home, they beat the dog with a stick. They broke the dishes. They tore their clothes to pieces. They spanked their baby brother, Arthur. Their mother began to cry. "You are not keeping your promise," she said. "We will be good," said Dolores. "We promise," said Sandra. "I can't wait much longer," said their mother. "Please try." Early the next morning, before their mother was awake, Dolores and Sandra ran to see the gypsy girl. They told her all about the bad things they had done the day before. "We were horrid," said Sandra. "We were worse than we have ever been," said Dolores. "Can we have the drum now, please?" "No," said the gypsy girl. "I never meant to give it to you. It was just a game we were playing. I thought you knew that." Dolores and Sandra began to cry. They rushed home as quickly as they could, but their mother and Arthur were gone.
They are out shopping, said Dolores. They'll be back soon.
But they were still not back when time for lunch came. Dolores and Sandra felt lonely and scared. They wandered through the fields the rest of the day.
Maybe they will be home when we get back, said Dolores.
When they got home, they saw through the window that the lamps were lit, and there was a fire in the fireplace. But they did not see their mother and Arthur. Instead, there was their new mother, her glass eyes glistening, her wooden tail thumping on the floor. The window. Margaret and her brothers, Paul and David, shared a small house on top of a hill just outside the village. It was so warm one summer's night that Margaret could not sleep. She sat up in bed and in the darkness of her room watched the moon move across the sky. Suddenly, something caught her eye. She saw two small yellow-green lights moving through the woods near the graveyard at the bottom of the hill. They looked like the eyes of some animal, but she could not make out what kind of creature it was. Soon the creature left the woods and moved up the hill toward the house. For a few minutes, Margaret lost sight of it. Then she saw it coming across the lawn toward her window. It looked something like a man, and yet it didn't. Margaret was terrified. She wanted to run from her room, but the door was next to her window. She was afraid the creature would see her and break in before she could escape. When the creature turned and moved in another direction, Margaret rushed to the door. But before she could open the door, it was back. Margaret found herself staring through the window at a shrunken face like that of a mummy. Its yellow-green eyes gleamed like a cat's eyes. She wanted to scream, but she was so frightened that she could not make a sound. The creature broke the window glass, unlocked the window, and crawled inside. Margaret tried to flee, but the creature caught her. It twisted its long, bony fingers into her hair, pulled back her head, and sank its teeth into her throat. Margaret screamed and fainted. When her brothers heard her piercing scream, they rushed to her room. But by the time they got the door unlocked, the creature had fled. Margaret lay on the floor, bleeding and unconscious. While Paul tried to stop the bleeding, David chased the creature down the hill toward the churchyard, but soon he lost sight of it. The police thought it was the work of an escaped lunatic who believed he was a vampire. When Margaret recovered, her brothers wanted to move to a safer place where it would be harder to break in, but Margaret refused. The creature would never come back, she was sure of that. But just in case, Paul and David began to keep loaded pistols in their rooms. One night, months later, Margaret was awakened by a scratching sound at the window. When she opened her eyes, there was the same shrunken face staring in at her. That night, her brothers heard her cries in time. They chased the creature down the hill, and David shot it in the leg. But the creature managed to scramble over the graveyard wall and disappeared near an old burial vault. The next day, Margaret and her brothers watched as the sexton of the church opened the burial vault. Inside was a horrifying scene. Broken coffins, bones, and rotting flesh were scattered all over the floor. Only one coffin had not been disturbed. When the sexton opened it, there lay the creature with the shrunken face that had attacked Margaret. The telltale bullet was in its leg. They did the only thing they knew of to rid themselves of a vampire. The sexton built a roaring blaze outside the vault and fed the shrunken body to the flames. They watched the body burn until nothing remained but ashes. Wonderful sausage! One dark, rainy Saturday afternoon, a fat and jolly butcher named Samuel Blunt had an argument over money with his wife, Eloise. Blunt lost his temper and killed Eloise. Then he ground her up into sausage meat and buried her bones under a big flat rock in the backyard. To keep the murder a secret, he told everyone she had moved away. Blunt mixed his new sausage meat with pork, then seasoned it with salt and pepper, added some sage and thyme and a bit of garlic. To give it a special flavor, he smoked it in his smokehouse for a while. He called it Blunt's Special Sausage. There was such a demand for this new sausage that Blunt bought the best hogs he could find and started raising his own pork. He also kept a sharp lookout for humans who might make a tasty sausage meat. One day, a nice, plump schoolteacher came into his shop. Blunt grabbed her and ground her up. Another time, Blunt's dentist came by. He was a little, round man, and into the grinder he went. Then one by one, the children in the neighborhood began to disappear, and so did their kittens and puppies. But no one ever dreamed that Blunt the butcher had anything to do with it. Things went on that way for years. Then one day, Blunt made a big mistake. A fat boy came into the butcher shop. Blunt grabbed him and started to drag him off to the sausage grinder. But the boy broke loose and ran out of the shop, and Blunt chased after him, waving a big butcher knife. When people saw this, they realized at once what had become of all the missing children and grown-ups and kittens and puppies. An angry crowd gathered at the butcher shop. No one knows for sure just what happened to Blunt that day. Some say he was fed to his hogs. Others say he was fed to his sausage grinder. But he was never seen again. And neither was his wonderful sausage meat. The Cat's Paw.
Somebody was stealing the meat Jed Smith kept in his smokehouse. Every day a ham or some bacon or something else was missing. Finally, Jed decided he had to put a stop to it. One night, he hid in the smokehouse with his rifle and waited for the thief. He didn't have to wait long, for soon a black she-cat slunk in. She was the biggest cat Jed had ever seen. When she jumped up and pulled down a ham hanging from the ceiling, Jed grabbed his rifle and turned on the lights. But instead of running away, the cat jumped at him. He fired and shot off one of her paws. Jed was sure he heard a woman scream right after his gun went off. The cat began tearing around the room, spitting and yowling. Then she ran up the chimney and was gone. Jed stared at the cat's paw. Only it wasn't a cat's paw anymore. A woman's foot lay wriggling on the floor, all shot up and bloody. So, it's a witch that's been doing it, he told himself. Just then, one of Jed's neighbors, a fellow named Burdick, came racing down the road to get a doctor. His wife's foot had been shot in an accident, he told Jed. She's bleeding pretty bad, he said. The doctor got to her barely in time. People who were there when it happened said that she was spitting and yowling just like a cat.
The Voice. Ellen had just fallen asleep when she heard a strange voice.
Ellen, it whispered, I am coming up the stairs. I am on the first step. Now I am on the second step.
Ellen got scared and called her parents, but they didn't hear her, and they didn't come. Then the voice whispered,
Ellen, I'm on the top step. Now I'm in the hall. Now I'm outside your room. Then it whispered, I'm standing right next to your bed.
And then,
I've got you!
Ellen screamed, and the voice stopped. Her father rushed into the room and turned on the light. Somebody's in here, Ellen said. They looked and looked.
Nobody was there.
Oh, Susanna. Susanna and Jane shared a small apartment near the university where they were students. When Susanna got back from the library one night, the lights were out and Jane was asleep. Susanna undressed in the dark and quietly got into bed. She had almost fallen asleep when she heard someone humming the tune to the song, Oh, Susanna. Jane, she said, please stop humming. I want to get some sleep. Jane didn't answer, but the humming stopped and Susanna fell asleep. She awakened early the next morning, too early, she decided, and was trying to get back to sleep when she heard the humming again. Please go back to sleep, she told Jane. It's too early to get up. Jane didn't answer, but the humming continued. Susanna became angry. Cut it out, she said. It's not funny. When the humming still did not stop, she lost her temper. She jumped out of bed, pulled the covers off Jane, and screamed.
Jane's head was gone. Somebody had cut off her head. I'm having a nightmare, Susanna told herself. When I wake up, everything will be all right.
The Man in the Middle. It was almost midnight. Sally Truitt had just gotten on the subway train at 50th Street after visiting her mother. Don't worry, Sally had told her. The subway is safe. There's always a policeman on duty. But that night she didn't see one. Except for her, the subway car was empty. At 42nd Street, three tough-looking men got on. Two of them were holding up the third, who looked drunk. His head rolled from side to side, and his legs refused to work. When they got him seated between them, his head came to rest on one of his shoulders. Sally thought he was staring at her. She buried her head in a book and tried not to notice. At 28th Street, one of the men stood up.
Take it easy, Jim,
he said to the man in the middle, and he got off. At 23rd Street, Jim's other friend stood up.
You'll be fine, he said, and he got off.
Now the only ones left in the car were Jim and Sally. Just then the train went around a sharp curve, and Jim pitched onto the floor at Sally's feet. When she looked down at him, she saw a trickle of blood on the side of his head, and just above it, a bullet hole. The cat in a shopping bag. Mrs. Briggs was driving to the shopping mall to do some last-minute Christmas shopping when she accidentally ran over a cat. She could not bear to leave the corpse on the road for other cars to hit and squash, so she stopped, wrapped the cat in some tissue paper she had with her, and put it in an old shopping bag in the back seat. She would bury it in the backyard when she got home. At the mall, she parked her car and began walking to one of the stores. She had taken only a few steps when, out of the corner of her eye, she saw a woman reach into the open window of her car and take the shopping bag with the dead cat. Then the woman quickly got into a car nearby and drove away. Mrs. Briggs ran back to her car and followed the woman. She caught up with her at a diner down the road. She followed her inside and watched the woman slide into a booth and give a waitress her order. As the woman sat sipping her soda, she reached into Mrs. Briggs' shopping bag. Then she bent down and looked inside. A look of horror crossed her face. She screamed and fainted. The waitress called an ambulance. Two attendants carried the woman away on a stretcher, but they left the shopping bag behind. Mrs. Briggs picked up the bag and ran after them. "This is hers," she called. "It's her Christmas present. She wouldn't want to lose it." The Bed by the Window. The three old men shared a room at the nursing home. Their room had only one window, but for them it was the only link to the real world. Ted Conklin, who had been there the longest, had the bed next to the window. When Ted died, the man in the next bed, George Best, took his place, and the third man, Richard Green, took George's bed. Despite his illness, George was a cheerful man, who spent his days describing the sights he could see from his bed. Pretty girls, a policeman on horseback, a traffic jam, a pizza parlor, a fire station, and other scenes of life outside. Richard loved to listen to George, but the more George talked about the life outside, the more Richard wanted to see it for himself. Yet he knew that only when George died would he have his chance. He wanted to look out that window so badly that one day he decided to kill George. "He's going to die soon anyway," he told himself. "What difference would it make?" George had a bad heart. If he had an attack during the night and a nurse could not get to him right away, he had pills he could take. He kept them in a bottle on top of the cabinet between his bed and Richard's. All Richard had to do was knock the bottle to the floor where George could not reach it. A few nights later, George died, just as Richard had planned he would. And the next morning, Richard was moved to the bed by the window. Now he would see for himself all the things outside that George had described. After the nurses had left, Richard turned to the window and looked out. But all he could see was a blank brick wall. The Dead Man's Hand. The students at the school for nurses got along quite well with one another, except for Alice. The trouble with Alice was that she was perfect. At least, that is how it seemed to the other students. She was always friendly and always cheerful. Nothing ever upset her. Her school assignments were always on time and always perfect. She didn't even bite her fingernails. Many of the student nurses resented Alice. They would have liked to see her fail at something, become frightened or cry, or do something that showed she had weaknesses like they did. One night, several students tried to frighten Alice with a practical joke. They borrowed the hand of a corpse they had been studying in anatomy and tied it to the light cord in her closet. When she tried to turn on the light, she would find herself holding a dead man's hand. "That would scare anybody," one of them said. "If it doesn't scare her, nothing will." After tying the hand in place, they went to the movies. When they got back, Alice was asleep. But when they didn't see her the next morning, they decided to find out what had happened. There was no sign of Alice in her room, but they soon found her. She was sitting on the floor in her closet, staring at the dead man's hand and mumbling to herself. Alice didn't even look up. The joke had worked, but nobody was laughing. A Ghost in the Mirror. This is a scary game that young people sometimes play, trying to conjure up a ghost in their bathroom mirror. Many don't really believe that a ghost is going to appear, but they try to raise one anyway, for the fun and the excitement. Some are willing to settle for any ghost, but others have a particular ghost in mind. One of these is a ghost named Mary Worth, who is also known as Mary Jane and Bloody Mary. She is the heroine of an old comic strip, but some say she actually was a witch who was hanged at the infamous witch trials in Salem, Massachusetts in 1692. Another of these ghosts is La Llorona, the weeping woman who wanders the streets of cities and towns from Texas to California and throughout Mexico, looking for her lost child. Still another is Mary Wales, a young woman who is supposed to have been killed in a car accident in Indianapolis, Indiana, about 1965. Her ghost is one of the vanishing hitchhikers. It is said that again and again she thumbs a ride home in a passing car, then vanishes before she gets there. Here is how ghost hunters try to raise a ghost. One, they find a quiet bathroom, close the door, and turn off the lights. Two, while they stare at their face in the mirror, they repeat the ghost's name, usually 47 times or 100 times. If any ghost will do, they say any ghost in place of a name. If they do manage to raise one, its face will slowly replace their face in the mirror. Some say a ghost is likely to be angry at being disturbed. If it gets angry enough, they say, it will try to shatter the mirror and come right into the room. But a player can always turn on the lights and send the ghost back to where it came from. And when that happens, the game is over. The Curse. My dad's friend, Charlie Potter, was a small, nervous man who was always looking around as if he was in some kind of danger. After he told me this story about his college fraternity, I understood why. The frat doesn't exist anymore, he said. It was banned years ago. We had just 9 members at that point, and we were taking in 2 more, Jack Lawton and Ernie Kramer. One night in January, just about this time of year, the 9 of us took them out into the country for their initiation. We took them to an old deserted house where 2 young men about our age had been murdered recently. Their murderer was still at large.
We gave Jack a lighted candle and told him to go up to the third floor. Stay there for an hour, we told him. Then come back down. Don't speak. Don't make any noise. If your candle goes out, carry on in the dark. From where we were standing, we could see the light from Jack's candle moving up the stairs to the second floor and then to the third. But when he got to the third floor, his candle went out. We guessed that he had come to a drafty corner and the wind blew it out. But when the hour went by and he didn't come down, we weren't so sure. We waited another 15 minutes and then got more and more nervous. So we sent Ernie Kramer up after him. When Ernie got to the third floor, his candle also went out. We waited 10 minutes, 20 minutes, but there was no sign of either of them. Come on down, we called, but they didn't answer. Finally, we decided to go and get them. Armed with flashlights, we started up the stairs. It was as quiet and dark as a grave in that house. When we got to the second floor, we called out again, but there was no answer. When we got to the third floor, we walked into a great big open space like an attic. Jack and Ernie weren't there, but we saw footprints in the dust. These led to a room on the other side of the attic. That room was also empty, but there was fresh blood on the floor, and the window was wide open. It was about 25 feet to the ground, but there was no ladder or rope in sight that they could have used to get down. We searched the rest of the house and the land around the house and found nothing. We decided that they were playing a trick on us. We figured that in some way they had escaped through the window and were hiding in the woods. The blood on the floor was to throw us off the track. We guessed that they'd show up the next day with a lot of stories and a lot of laughs, but they didn't. The next day, we told the Dean of Men what had happened, and he reported it to the police. The police didn't find anything either, and after several weeks, the search ended. To this day, no one knows what happened to Jack Lawton and Ernie Kramer. There isn't much more to tell, he said. We weren't arrested, but the college disbanded the fraternity and suspended the 9 of us from school for a year. The strangest part came after we graduated. Someone must have placed a curse on us. Every year since then, around the time of that initiation, one of us has died or gone crazy. I'm the only one left, he said, and I'm in pretty good health. But there are times when I feel just a little peculiar.
The church.
There was a fella named Larry Berger who wasn't afraid of anybody alive. But anybody who was dead scared the wits out of him. One night, Larry was out driving in the country in his old Jeep when he got caught in a bad thunderstorm. The rain was coming down in sheets. Since his Jeep didn't have a top to it, Larry started looking for a place to take shelter. But at the first place he came to, he didn't even slow down. It was an old deserted cabin, probably as dry as a bone inside. But Larry knew for a fact that it was haunted, and he wasn't going to stay there. A few miles farther, he came to an old abandoned church standing all alone in a field. It hadn't been used in years. All the window glass was gone, but it still had sections of the roof intact. So Larry parked his Jeep and ran inside. It was as dark as could be in there. Larry groped around until he found a pew and sat down.
It was nice and dry, just as he thought it would be, and he stretched out his legs and made himself comfortable. Suddenly there was a big flash of lightning, and Larry saw that he wasn't the only one in that church. There were people sitting in almost every pew. They all had their heads bowed as if they were praying, and they all were dressed in white. These must be ghosts sitting in their shrouds, Larry thought. They must have come in from some graveyard to get dry. Larry jumped up and ran down the aisle as fast as he could, right smack into one of those ghosts. And the ghost, he went...
The bad news. Leon and Todd loved baseball. When they were young, they had played on the town's baseball team. Leon had been the pitcher, and Todd had played second base. Now that they were a lot older, they spent their free time watching baseball games on TV and talking about baseball. "Do you think they play baseball in heaven?" Leon asked Todd one day.
"Well, that's a good question," said Todd. "The one who gets there first should let the other one know somehow."
As it turned out, Todd got to heaven first, and Leon waited patiently to hear from him. One day, Leon found Todd sitting in the living room waiting for him.
Leon was very excited to see him. "Well, what is it like up there?" he asked. "And what about baseball?"
"When it comes to baseball," said Todd, "I have some good news and I have some bad news. The good news is that we do play baseball in heaven. We have some fine teams. I play second base on my team just like I used to in the old days. That's the good news."
"What's the bad news?" asked Leon.
"The bad news," said Todd, "is that you are scheduled to pitch tomorrow."
Cemetery Soup. On her way home from the market, the woman took a shortcut through the cemetery. There, sticking up out of the ground, she saw a big bone. She picked it up and looked it over carefully.
This will make a very good soup bone," she said. "I think I'll take it home. It's perfect weather for hot soup."
When she got home, the first thing she did was start the soup. Into the big soup pot went water, carrots, green beans, corn, barley, onions, potatoes, a snitch of beef, some salt and pepper, and the bone. She brought it all to a boil, then brought it down to a simmer.
"Yum," she said, sniffing it and tasting it. "I can hardly wait till supper."
Suddenly, she heard a small voice. "Please give me back my bone." The woman paid no attention. Soon she heard the voice again. "May I have back my bone, please?" The woman was reading the newspaper, and again she didn't take any notice. In a little while, the voice spoke up once more. It was beginning to sound angry.
"Give me back my bone."
The woman kept on reading the paper.
"Some people are too impatient," she muttered.
Once more the voice spoke. Now it sounded very angry, and it was so loud that the whole house shook.
"I want my bone back!"
The woman reached into the pot, grabbed the bone, and threw it out the window.
In a voice just as loud, she shouted, "Take it!"
There was an eerie silence. Then the woman heard footsteps scurrying away from the house down the road toward the cemetery. And she got up and served herself some soup.
The Brown Suit. A woman came to the funeral parlor to see her husband's corpse.
You did a good job, she said to the undertaker. He looks just the way he always looked, except for one thing. My husband always wore a brown suit, but you have him dressed in a blue suit.
Well, that is no problem, said the undertaker. We can easily change it.
When she returned later, her husband was wearing a brown suit. Now he looks just the way he always did, she said. I know you went to a lot of trouble.
It was no trouble, he said. As it happened, there is a man here who was wearing a brown suit, and his widow felt that blue would be better. He is about your husband's size, so we gave him the blue one and gave your husband the brown one.
Even so, she said, changing all that clothing was a big job.
Not really, said the undertaker. All we did was exchange their heads.
Baroom.
O'Leary is dead and O'Reilly don't know it. O'Reilly is dead and O'Leary don't know it. They both are dead in the very same bed, and neither one knows that the other one's dead. Baroom. Baroom. O'Leary is dead and O'Reilly don't know it. O'Reilly is dead and O'Leary don't know it. They both are dead in the very same bed, and neither one knows that the other one's dead. Baroom. Baroom.
Thumpity-thump.
When we moved to Schenectady from Schoharie, we rented a house awful cheap because it was spooked, and nobody would live in it. But we didn't care because we didn't take no stock in spooks. We had just gone to bed the first night, dog-tired from riding in a wagon all day. We hadn't had time to shut our eyes when we heard a thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump. Coming down the attic stairs. I covered my head with the blankets, but I couldn't shut out the sound. Thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump it went. I could hear it, plain as day. Past the bedroom door, thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump, and down the stairs, thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump, and through the kitchen, thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump, and down the cellar stairs, thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump, making the most awful racket you ever heard. It was more than we could stand. So we all followed the sound to see what was going on. When we got down the cellar stairs, we saw that it was a chair that had made all of that racket. There it was, with one of its legs pointing to a place on the dirt floor. We all just stood and gawped till my brother Ike said that he believed that the chair was trying to tell us something about the place it was pointing at. So Ike went and got a shovel and started digging. He didn't have to dig far before his shovel struck something hard. Pretty soon we could see the edge of a box sticking out. We all hollered for him to hurry up and uncover the rest of it. And the chair, it got so excited, it jumped up and down like it had gone plumb crazy. When Ike got the box uncovered, Pop and the boys pried off the lid, and there was the body of a man all smooched with blood. It was plain as the nose on your face that he had been murdered, and the chair wanted folks to know it. Right then and there, we decided to leave. Being strangers, everybody would think that we had murdered him and come there to hide the body. It didn't take us long to fill up that hole and get out of that house. The chair was awful mad about our leaving, and it went up the cellar stairs thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump, louder than when it had gone down. Then it thumpity-thumped up the next set of stairs, and the next louder still. When it got back into the attic, it thumpity-thumped so loud we thought it would thump all the plastering down on our heads. Nobody asked us why we were moving out so soon, 'cause nobody ever stayed more than one night in that place, and most not that long.
But I can tell you, we were thankful to get back to Schoharie, where chairs stay where they're put, and don't go rearing and rampaging round, scaring folks out of their wits, pointing out murders and goodness knows what.
The Appointment. A 16-year-old boy worked on his grandfather's horse farm. One morning, he drove a pickup truck into town on an errand. While he was walking along the main street, he saw death. Death beckoned to him. The boy drove back to the farm as fast as he could and told his grandfather what had happened. "Give me the truck," he begged. "I'll go to the city. He'll never find me there." His grandfather gave him the truck, and the boy sped away. After he left, his grandfather went into town looking for death. When he found him, he asked, "Why did you frighten my grandson that way? He's only 16. He's too young to die." "I am sorry about that," said Death. "I did not mean to beckon to him, but I was surprised to see him here. You see, I have an appointment with him this afternoon in the city."
The bus stop. Ed Cox was driving home from work in a rainstorm. While he waited for a traffic light to change, he saw a young woman standing alone at the bus stop. She had no umbrella and was soaking wet. "Are you going toward Farmington?" he called. "Yes, I am," she said. "Would you like a ride home?" "I would," she said, and she got in. "My name is Joanna Finney. Thank you for rescuing me." "I'm Ed Cox," he said, "and you're welcome." On the way, they talked and talked. She told him about her family and her job and where she had gone to school, and he told her about himself. By the time they got to her house, the rain had stopped. "I'm glad it rained," Ed said. "Would you like to go out tomorrow after work?" "I'd love to," Joanna said. She asked him to meet her at the bus stop, since it was near her office. Well, they had such a good time, they went out many times after that. Always they would meet at the bus stop, and off they would go. Ed liked her more each time he saw her. But one night, when they had a date to go out, Joanna did not appear. Ed waited at the bus stop for almost an hour. "Maybe something's wrong," he thought. And he drove to her house in Farmington. An older woman came to the door. "I'm Ed Cox," he said. "Maybe Joanna told you about me. I had a date with her tonight. We were supposed to meet at the bus stop near her office. But she didn't show up. Is she all right?" The woman looked at him as if he had said something strange. "I am Joanna's mother," she said slowly. "Joanna isn't here now, but why don't you come in?" Ed pointed to a picture on the mantel. "Well, that looks just like her," he said. "It did, once," her mother replied. "But that picture was taken when she was your age, about 20 years ago. A few days later, she was waiting in the rain at that bus stop. A car hit her, and she was killed."
Faster and faster.
Sam and his cousin Bob went walking in the woods. The only sounds were leaves rustling and now and again a bird chirping.
"It's so quiet here," Bob whispered.
But that soon changed. After a few minutes, the two boys started whooping and hollering and chasing one another around. Sam ducked behind a tree. When Bob came by, Sam jumped out at him. Then Bob raced ahead and hid behind a bush. When he looked down, there at his feet was an old drum. "Sam, see what I found," he called.
It looks like a tom-tom. I bet it's 100 years old. Look at the red stains on it, said Sam. I bet it's somebody's blood. Let's get out of here. But Bob could not resist trying the drum. He sat on the ground and held it between his legs. He beat on it with one hand, then the other, slowly at first, then faster and faster, almost as if he could not stop. Suddenly there were shouts in the woods and the sound of hoofbeats. A cloud of dust rose from behind a line of trees. Then men on horseback galloped toward them. Bob, let's go, Sam shouted. He began to run. Hurry! Bob dropped the drum and ran after him. Sam heard the twang of a bow firing an arrow. Then he heard Bob scream. When Sam turned, he saw Bob pitch forward, dead. But there was no arrow in his body, and there was no wound. And when the police searched, there were no men on horseback, and there were no hoofprints, and there was no drum. The only sounds were leaves rustling, and now and again a bird chirping. Just delicious. George Flint loved to eat. Each day at noon, he closed his camera shop for 2 hours and went home for a big lunch his wife, Mina, cooked for him. George was a bully, and Mina was a timid woman who did everything he asked because she was afraid of him. On his way home for lunch one day, George stopped at the butcher shop and bought a pound of liver. He loved liver. He would have Mina cook it for dinner that night. Despite all his complaints about her, she was a very good cook. While George ate his lunch, Mina told him that a rich old woman in town had died. Her body was in the church next door. It was in an open coffin. Anyone who wanted to see her could. As usual, George was not interested in what Mina had to say. "I've got to go back to work," he told her. After he left, Mina began to cook the liver. She added vegetables and spices and simmered it all afternoon, just the way George liked it. When she thought it was done, she cut off a small piece and tasted it. It was delicious, the best she had ever made. She ate a second piece, then a third. It was so good she couldn't stop eating it. It was only when the liver was all gone that she thought of George. He would be coming home soon. What would he do when he found that she had eaten all of the liver? Some men would laugh, but not George. He would be angry and mean, and she didn't want to face that again. But where could she get another piece of liver that late in the day? Then she remembered the old woman lying in the church next door, waiting to be buried. George said he never had a better dinner.
"Have some liver, Mina," he said. "It's just delicious."
"I'm not hungry," she said. "You finish it." That night, after George had fallen asleep, Mina sat in bed trying to read. But all she could think about was what she had done. Then she thought she heard a woman's voice.
"Who has my liver?" it asked. "Who has it?"
Was it her imagination? Was she dreaming? Now the voice was closer.
"Who has my liver?" it asked. "Who has it?"
Mina wanted to run. "No, no," she whispered. "I don't have it. I don't have your liver." Now the voice was right next to her.
"Who has my liver?" it asked. "Who has it?"
Mina froze with terror. She pointed to George. "He does," she said. "He has it." Suddenly the light went out, and George screamed and screamed. Hello, Kate. Tom Connors was on his way to a dance in the next village. It was a long walk through fields and woods, but it was a soft, sweet evening, and he loved dancing, so Tom didn't mind. He'd gone only a short distance when he noticed a young woman following him. Maybe she's going to the dance, he thought, and he stopped and waited for her. As the woman got closer, he saw that it was Kate Faherty. They had danced together many times. He was about to call, "Hello, Kate," when suddenly he remembered that Kate was dead. She had died last year, yet there she was, all dressed up for the dance. Tom wanted to run, but somehow it didn't seem right to run from Kate. He turned and started to walk away as fast as he could, but Kate followed him. He took a shortcut across a field, but still she followed. When he got to the dance hall, she was right behind him. There were a lot of people standing outside, and Tom tried to lose Kate in the crowd. He worked his way to the side of the building, then squeezed up against the wall behind some people, but Kate followed. She came so close she brushed up against him. Then she stopped and waited. He wanted to say, "Hello, Kate," just the way he did when she was alive, but he was so frightened he couldn't speak. Her eyes looked into his eyes, and she vanished. The Black Dog. It was 11 o'clock at night. Peter Rothberg was in bed on the second floor of the old house where he lived alone. It had gotten so chilly, he went downstairs to turn up the heat. On his way back to bed, a black dog ran down the stairs. It passed him and disappeared into the darkness. "Where did you come from?" Peter said. He'd never seen the dog before. He turned on all the lights and looked in every room. He couldn't find the dog anywhere. He went outside and brought in the two watchdogs he kept in the backyard, but they acted as if they were the only dogs in the house. The next night, again at 11 o'clock, Peter was in his bedroom. He heard what sounded like a dog walking around in the room above him. He dashed upstairs and threw open the door. The room was empty. He looked under the bed. He looked in the closet. Nothing. But when he got back to his bedroom, he heard a dog running down the stairs. It was the black dog. He tried to follow it, but again, he couldn't find where it had gone. From then on, every night at 11, Peter heard the dog walking in the room above him. The room was always empty. But after he left, the dog would come out of hiding, run down the stairs, and disappear. One night, Peter's neighbor waited with him for the dog. At the usual time, they heard it above them. Then they heard it on the stairs. When they went out into the hall, it was standing at the foot of the stairs, looking up at them. The neighbor whistled, and the dog wagged its tail. Then it was gone. Things went on this way until the night Peter decided to bring his watchdogs into the house again. Maybe this time they would find the black dog and drive it away. Just before 11, he took them up to his bedroom and left the door open. Then he heard the black dog moving around above him. The dogs pricked up their ears and ran to the door. Suddenly they bared their teeth and snarled and backed away. Peter could not see the black dog or hear it, but he was sure that it had entered his room. His dogs barked and snapped. They darted forward nervously, then backed away again. Suddenly one of them yelped. It began bleeding, then dropped to the floor, its neck torn open. A minute later, it was dead. Peter's other dog backed into a corner, whimpering. Then everything was still. The next night, Peter's neighbor came back with a pistol. Again they waited in his bedroom. At 11 o'clock, the black dog came down the stairs. As before, it looked up at them and wagged its tail. When they started toward it with a pistol, it growled and disappeared. That was the last Peter saw of the black dog. But it didn't mean that the dog was gone. Now and then, always at 11, he heard it moving around above him. Once he heard it running down the stairs. He never managed to see it again, but he knew that it was there. Footsteps. Liz was doing her homework at the dining room table. Her younger sister, Sarah, was asleep upstairs. Their mother was out, but she was expected back any minute. When the front door opened and shut, Liz called, "Hello, Mama!" But her mother didn't answer, and the footsteps Liz heard were heavier, like a man's. "Who's there?" she called. No one replied. She heard whoever it was walk through the living room, then up the stairs to the second floor. The footsteps moved from one bedroom to another. Again Liz called. "Who's there?" The footsteps stopped. Then she thought, "Oh my God, Sarah's in her bedroom." She ran upstairs to Sarah's room. Only Sarah was there, and she was asleep. Liz looked in the other rooms, but found no one. She went back down to the dining room, scared out of her wits.